Welcome to the Reinventing Finance podcast hosted by Tom van der Lubbe and Nikolaus Syr. This podcast is for anyone who's interested in the developments of the InsurTech, insurance, fintech and finance market. Join us as we discover what some of the current industry leaders and decision makers are doing, the lessons they have learned, the main challenges and opportunities they identify, and how they see the current status of the insurance and finance industry.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to our next episode of Reinventing Finance with my co-host, Tom, and our next guest, Suzanne. Suzanne, without further ado, who are you and what do you do?
Thanks so much, Nicholas, for having me on your program. Loving the podcast which you have started. And my name is Suzanne Cisti. I'm the CEO and the founder of FinTech Circle. And I am originally from Austria, so I came to London, you know, more than 20 years to work in the financial services sector. So for a consulting company, Accenture, then I moved into banking and worked for Morgan Stanley in London and in Hong Kong. Then I moved to Lloyds Bank and then at the end to Deutsche Bank. And then about 5 years ago, I launched FinTech Circle. And FinTech Circle is a company where we do a few things. On one side, we invest in FinTech startups. So our goal is to find the best FinTech entrepreneurs and match them up with the best FinTech investors. So early stage angel investors. Secondly, what we do is we write books on FinTech topics. And we have got a whole range of best-selling books which are published by Wiley on different sub-verticals of the FinTech sector. And then we also work with banks. We work with accelerators. And I'm on the board, you know, of a bank. I'm on the board of FinTech companies and advise companies, both, you know, established and startups and scale-ups, and which are launched a scale-up program as well as part of FinTech Circle to help companies scale up and grow and fulfill their potential. So really delighted to be here with you today.
Suzanne, awesome. I mean, there's so many threads. So let me try to pull on a couple and see where we land. So I think it's fair to say that you've been there, done that. If you were to try to condense, you know, what have you seen? What has surprised you? And I'm not going, you know, whether it was over the last few years or in total. If someone said, you know, Suzanne, from having been part of the industry, seeing a change, what are your key takeaways from all the things that you've done and seen?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, 5 years ago when I started FinTech Circle, the reason why I started it because people in banking, you know, such as myself at that time, had no idea about FinTech. It was, you know, people in banking, insurance, you know, FinTech, InsurTech just did not, was not a theme, you know, innovation was being almost made impossible by the compliance requirements after the financial crisis. So all large financial institutions just focused on being compliant, you know, making sure that they are funding must-have compliance programs, but money for and budgets for innovation were small and were not seen as a priority because it almost seemed that there was not much change, you know, happening in financial services at all. And then all of a sudden, you know, the FinTech revolution started. Things are changing. And that's what I saw as a surprise, really, is the mind shift. You know, where bankers in the past, you know, living in maybe in ivory towers, you know, not having access to the FinTech community, all of a sudden now realize that FinTech is the future of finance, and FinTech actually helps them to improve their careers. Number one, you know, if you know how to use FinTech solutions for your own personal benefit in your career, you can be more efficient, you know, more effective. So it's actually a career booster. And secondly, it actually allows banks to compete with the tech giants, you know, who are moving in. So I think one of the surprising things definitely, Nicholas, was this mind shift, you know, of initially seeing fintech, insurtech as a competitor, to now seeing them as a helpful partner to innovate and modernize large institutions in the financial services.
I think, and I, you know, it's like I couldn't have slipped you the notes, you know, in any better way. But please correct me if you think that basically, do you see that as well? And maybe do you feel that banking is already a little bit further ahead then? Because I have an insurance angle usually, but I think when we started 5 years ago, six years ago, it was about insurtech. You know, there was a first wave of insurtech. It was about distribution disruption. That didn't come. Then it was about, you know, enabling. Now you have competing insurers. But at the end of the day, for most executives within the big organizations or small, it was still less risky, just kind of wait and see, because of the, quite frankly, inertia of the customers, the distributors, and fundamentally the stakeholders with the product. Now, what we see, and quite frankly, Corona has had a boost on this, is there's a shift. And I think it's really fundamental what you said around what has changed on the risk reward metric for executives, for people making, you know, they don't have to be entrepreneurs. They, you know, they're not incentivized like that, but it's, you know, everyone needs to make their decisions on, you know, how to do well for the company, how to do well for themselves. And it's really four things. One is that I believe Corona has shown, especially these offline distribution angles, you know, offline agents and brokers, that digital tools are really here to help them, which wasn't there before. So they're requesting these things. Secondarily, we see a lot of competitors entering the market and showing that the I mean, no one can say you cannot build a neobank anymore and acquire massive amounts of customers. So I think there is a digitalization of the supply side with direct competition. I also think there is a realization that replatforming of banks, certainly insurance companies where they invested hundreds of millions, 3 to 5 years in, don't really deliver, you know, at point. And then what we also see is there's a huge big opportunity, and everyone's got embedded finance, embedded insurance. So it's not just about efficiency. I think people kind of see, if I repackage my product and put it into these fast moving, fast changing distribution channels, I can create a growth story. How does that resonate with what you're seeing in your discussions with corporates as well? Or is this just my view and the insurance view?
No, 100% correct, Nicholas. You know, and it's a great summary of all these things which happen in our industry. And I totally agree. So I think on one side, you know, I can see that you're right to say that fintech has been ahead of insurtech. You know, so we definitely see the fintech sector. Banks have initially caught up first. Insurance came afterwards. Also, RegTech, you know, came afterwards. Now we see more PropTech, you know, property technology companies emerging more and more. And green finance is the next trend, you know, so the green finance, the green tech trend, the sustainability, ESG investing trend, it will be, I think, the hot topic of the next 10 years. So I think we see lots of different, different priorities, you know, over time emerging. So that's correct. Totally agree with what you said. I would say in terms of, you know, working with fintech companies, it is not easy for both sides, because I sit on both sides. I sit on, you know, the fintech company side, the insurtech company, you know, working with a large financial institution. There's often a clash of expectations, because it's a small startup. You are able to make fast decisions. You know, sometimes within a day, you can change direction. You can allocate resources where you see the best returns. You know, you can move ship, you can move direction very, very quickly. As a large organization, you are slowed down by your internal governance. you know, often everything is ruled and decided by committees, which only meet once a month. So you've got automatically everything slows down. And while, you know, a startup might have a certain runway, you know, before money dries out, and until that time, you have to make sure you show enough traction to your next round of investors. So you constantly fight time, you know, and you constantly want to achieve things. While for a large established company, you are one of many things, you know, they're working with, and they have normally they don't have time pressure because they've got other priorities. So it is not easy from the startup's point of view. And that's why, you know, when I speak to large established companies, I say, you know, respect the timely urgency of startups. And if it's a no, tell them quickly. You know, don't let startups wait and keep it as a maybes and have, you know, dozens of meetings when you know at the beginning already it won't work. And so that's very important to have a quick yes or a quick no, but not an ongoing, you know, process which doesn't end up in a licensing deal or in a sales opportunity. So that's really important how to treat startups fairly. And equally, you know, from a company's point of view, it is important that startups understand the procurement process. And that at the end of the day, when a large financial institution works with a startup, they are legally liable. You know, they are legally liable to their customers. And so they have to go through this very complicated procurement process. But I've seen banks in the UK, you know, for example, Barclays, they have made and improved the procurement process for startups to make it easier to work with them. And I think that's a fantastic idea, because when I think about banks, you know, what is their competitive edge? You know, one competitive ability is how fast can you turn a startup relationship into a profitable partnership? And if you can't do that because you're stuck by bureaucracy, you can't onboard great fintech companies because you're not allowed to do that, you limit your own innovation capacity. So it's bad for you, in fact, you know? So I think there's a balance to strike. And I think the most competitive banks will be the ones who can easily work with startups in the future. So that's, you know, very, very important. And I would say, you know, on the other side, you know, I'm on the board of a bank, you know, and when you think from a bank's point of view, banks, of course, acquire fintech companies. And the issue of this is that if you're a large institution which acquires a fintech company or any other, you know, tech startup or tech company, often it is not easy to integrate successfully. And you might lose value, you know, because the employees you acquired might leave after the golden handshakes are over. And so you acquired a shell, you know, you lose out the most important essence of innovation capacity and innovation or how you wanted to acquire. So, you know, acquiring startups is another skill set which established bankers need to learn and established, you know, board members need to learn. So I think that's why I think it's so exciting, Nicolas. That's why you and Tom, it's so important that you have got this podcast to share knowledge with the financial services sector at all levels in organizations, because we all need to learn better to work together, because otherwise value gets destroyed. You know, nobody wants that. But it's really about education and learning from each other and best practice sharing.
May I just ask or add on that? Can you just give a few examples of, let's say, big incumbents or big banks or big insurance companies where you say, okay, sometimes it's very difficult to align those interests, but these two or three examples are really excellent. One should dive into this if one understands how one should do it.
Yes. I mean, one known example, I guess, is, for example, BBVA. BBVA acquired Simple, you know, about 5 years ago. This was one of the first fintech acquisitions, you know, we heard of. And Simple was an online challenger bank. BBVA, of course, our large global bank. And it looked to me initially that it was a successful acquisition because, you know, the Simple continued under the BBVA brand name, but now then it was, you know, recently closed down and not being used anymore as was intended. So the question is then, I think, we don't know the reasons outside of the organization. Was it because the revenue share, you know, of this partnership, of the acquisition of Simple as a portion of the overall revenue shares of BBVA globally were so minor that it did not make sense, you know, for top management team to pay enough attention to it, or were there other reasons, you know, one doesn't know. But I think that was one acquisition which I thought initially went very well, you know, but then it kind of didn't discontinued. There are other acquisitions I know of which are not public, you know, so I can't share with you, but I know of some of those acquisitions. I can't share with you the names, you know, but the result often was that the fintech company was acquired, but then was switched off, you know, was literally switched off after a while because it was not seen as the relationship didn't work out. Or we can see tech giants acquiring companies just to stop them being competitors. You know, so those acquisitions also take place, which just acquire a threat, you know, if you've got big pockets to stop them from becoming a competitor, just closing them down. And then of course, other type of acquisitions are the acqui-hires, which is also interesting, Tom, you know, where people acquire teams just because they would love to hire them, but they know exactly they could never hire these top entrepreneurs. So they acquire the startup and then just to get access to the talent pool, you know. So we see different things in the industry, and it's fascinating, you know, what is going on at the moment.
I think you know, an acquisition, an acqui-hire, that, you know, in M&A, you know, it's really hard to get these organizations together and really get, you know, the outside scale and scope returns that, you know, I would also in my consulting days, you know, map out onto the chart and kind of making it all work. Would you, and I think with a kind of startup vibe, it might even be more of a delta on the cultures, but do you have maybe an example, or if not that, some best practices you see? Because I feel this kind of make or buy or partner, and how it's funny how people determine these words differently. I think make everyone understands, but what buy or partner actually means, that you see where you say, listen, they are partnering with fintechs or insurtechs, one, and two, any best practices on both sides to making the sales cycle and subsequently scale up more effective?
Yes, I would say there are a couple of, you know, best practices, and I can give you a few examples as well. So when I think about the insurance sector, for example, there's one company called Nimbler. So Nimbler, they insure invoices. So when you lend against an invoice which is being insured, you have got much more guarantee to get your money back, obviously, because it's being insured. So it's an additional service. And this company, Nimbler, is a UK company, and they're working in the UK market at the moment. And they have chosen the route you initially outlined, Nicolas, about embedded finance. It's almost embedded insurance. So they see themselves as a plug and play solution, which plugs into existing lending processes, so that a lender can work with Nimbler, and prior to a lending decision, the insurance can be protected before a lending decision is being communicated, you know, to the client. So that's a solution where the company works with established insurance companies and established banks and established finance providers. And the key thing is to be super professional, you know, as a fintech or insurtech company, you need to be as professional as your counterpart, as your client. And this means, normally it means to have lots of domain expertise. So it's not enough, you know, to just have started a startup with lacking or shallow domain expertise. You have to have deep knowledge in the sector to be taken seriously by people who might be more older, you know, more senior to you, but that you speak their language and that they know exactly, you understand their concerns, and they can trust you. You know, at the end of the day, it comes down to trust, that those relationships are being honored, and that the promises you make in writing are being honored in practice. So I think that's a very key thing. The other company, you know, I'm working with is Coriolis. Coriolis is a fintech company focused on trade finance, supply chains, and they work with banks helping banking clients who need trade finance solutions to get access to those trade finance solutions by providing data as a service. It's about trade data as a service. And again, this company, although it's a small company, they've got very experienced salespeople, relationship managers working with the banks, you know, to be the contact partner for the banks. And so again, that's a key thing, is to have the right, you know, relationship built with the banks. It becomes a win-win situation, which allows the banks to trust you, that you do your part, and it makes the life of the bankers easier. It's easily integrated, and there's no risk. There's no, you know, no big risk to think of. And so I would say those are two examples. I would say, you know, the key thing is to speak the language of your client, to be very credible, and to establish a relationship of trust, which you need to re-establish almost every day you work with them. You know, it's not enough at the beginning when you sign the contract, but they must see that you're fully committed and fully dedicated to this relationship, and vice versa. You know, the startup has to see the same thing. So it has to go both ways. And of course, what we see is that startups become scale-ups very quickly if they do this correctly, you know, because just working with one or two institutions can change your destiny completely, and then you are a scale-up and you grow so quickly. Then when we think about Revolut, I remember Revolut, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, a small startup. Now, you know, it's a global unicorn. So companies can become unicorns very fast in our sector. And that's another thing which is good for banks to know, because often banks have turned down startups when they were small, you know, didn't open the accounts. When I think about, you know, blockchain companies, cryptocurrency, fintech companies, often banks have turned them away. You know, didn't want to open bank accounts for them. But then a few years later, when they become really large, and then the investment bankers of the bank would like to sign the deals and work with those startups, you know, in the growth phase, of course, those startups will work with them who helped them on the journey up, you know. So it's give and take, and it's really about being seen as a fair player in the ecosystem and supporting companies from the beginning to their growth stage, because then you get access to late stage opportunities, which of course are much more profitable. But that's, I think that's the honest investment required, you know, from both sides.
Thank you so much. I'd like to, two follow-on questions on that. So totally get the B2B side. And I think it's the trust element is very important, because I think it's to appreciate that there's another party on the other end, and your champion needs to convince others within the organization. So anything around trust, and if you don't have, I mean, that's the reason why you buy Salesforce, right? It has trust. You don't think, you know, they're probably going to get the CRM, right? Not sure whether it's the best CRM, I don't know. But I think that's really important, and everything you do, you know, domain expertise, delivering, speaking the language, speaking about use cases, having, and I think it's also having a plan. It, you know, that plan might not work, but it's much easier for the other person to tinker with your plan than kind of then having them to say, how do you now sell me into your organization is really tough. So I think that works really well for the client side. Now on the investor side, that sounds like a lot of work. That sounds like relationship management, use cases, domain expert. Do I hear the word consulting in there? Is that even scalable? So how does that flip around? And from an investor point of view, that appreciation that, you know, we're talking not just enterprise, we're talking financial services enterprise. Do you have some feedback on that as well?
Yes. I mean, FinTech certainly, you know, we run our investor network where we select the best FinTech companies who apply to us to raise funding. And we have our selection days normally are 2-day events where we have about 16 FinTech, InsurTech, RegTech companies pitching to our jury. And each of those companies has got about half an hour time, about 50 minutes is a pitch, 50 minutes is a Q&A. And after those 2 days, we decide on the top 50% whom we take forward, you know, to our next coaching phase before the investor evening. And so as part of the selection, as you correctly said, you know, there are lots of things to look at, you know, as an investor. And it depends, first of all, you know, are you a regulated entity or not? So if it's a startup which is regulated, we very much look at the regulatory aspects as well. You know, have they ticked all the right boxes? Are they using agents to be regulated? Others have they regulated themselves? And the team. I mean, the first thing is the team, to be honest, because we want to make sure that the team is unique. You know, that the team has got this competitive advantage in terms of skill sets, experience, vision as well, and that the team is able to also pivot. You know, because we know from startups, often you can never figure it out initially how your future looks like in 5 years' time. But you have to be able to be responsive and change, you know, when the environment changes. And so the goal is to have teams which are able to change direction and still succeed. You know, that's it's okay to pivot, but the key thing is still, you know, not still being focused, you know, on what makes it, what is your value proposition. So we look at the team, we look at the products, the services, the unit economics. You know, some business models will never become profitable because the unit economics are so bad that the more you sell, the more money you lose. You know, so those business models they might still work in the Silicon Valley where it's all about big scale, you know, and being the first mover in the market. But I think in Europe, for European investors would like, and UK investors, you know, want to see some profitability at the end of the journey. So the unit economics must make sense from the outset. You know, you must see there's a path towards net revenues and towards profitability at some stage. And then we look at the market size overall, you know, the market size, the competitors in the market, how well funded the competitors are before we decide, you know, which company we invite and take forward in our selection criteria. And to your specific question, you know, regarding to B2B companies. So when investors review B2B companies and decide how and if they should invest in them, I think it depends on the stage. You know, on the stage of their life cycle. So for an early stage business, which is, let's say, early revenue, there are different selection criteria than if you've got a business which is close to profitability. You know, those companies which are close to profitability, but we think they've figured out the business model, they've validated the value proposition. So for them, it's just about increasing their sales force, you know, increasing their scale, and just replicating what they do at bigger scale than they, you know, so they just need money now to grow, but we don't need any more this initial validation and assumption validation phase to go through as in a startup. So it really depends on each stage, but I call this an investment ladder, you know, like a property ladder. You just jump, you know, from a startup initially, then we go to friends, family rounds to get access to capital, you know, from the friends and family, before that even to go to grants, which you don't have to pay back. So I always recommend any startup, you know, first go to grants and go to get free money, which you don't have to return. It's much better to do that. And then you come to angel investors, you know, such as FinTech Circle. Then you move to early stage investors, early stage VCs, late stage VCs until private equity. And then, you know, companies think about exits, and exits either, you know, you might get acquired from trade buyers, you know, financial institutions, or you might go for an IPO. What we see more and more companies actually choose to stay private for longer because there's enough cash in the private market. So we don't see that many fintech companies actually IPO. But I think the key thing, what I say is advice, Nicolas, to fintech founders, the fintech entrepreneurs, is you always should talk to investors before you need them. You know, because if you first talk to investors when you need the money urgently, it normally is too late because you want to have enough runway to choose wisely which money you take and which investors you take on board. Because once you choose investors on your cap table, It is like a marriage. You know, you're married to those investors and they should be staying with you in good and in bad times. and support you long term with smart capital, you know, with your content, with their contacts, their knowledge, their expertise, and good and in bad times, you know. So it's very important that the relationship works. And one of the entrepreneurs, you know, I worked with, the CEO of another a great company, he said to me, he only accepts investors whom he enjoys to go for lunch with, because he wants his personal relationship to be working, you know, before he lets them into his company, and which I completely understand. I think that's a fantastic criteria for an entrepreneur as well.
Awesome. I guess the second question, just to understand, because you used Revolut as an example before, we were kind of in the B2B space, and maybe I'm missing a beat there, but Revolut for me was an example. They didn't need to work with banks. They're competing against banks. That's basically the hypothesis. Banks are not going to get their beep in order. They're too slow and they cannot figure it out, and it's too entrenched. And so you'll just need to blow them out of the market and convince someone to fund that acquisition to building the next financial super app. Or am I missing something? Because I think Revolut never tried to work with banks.
You're right, Nicolas. Initially, it was just a B2C strategy. So very much, you know, competition towards, against banks, it being the B2C player, similar as TransferWise, you know, the FX solution, again, focused only on B2C, but both companies now are B2B as well. So they both have got, you know, B2B solutions. TransferWise, you know, has a B2B offering. So I think it's we see lots of companies who move into B2C, or Starling Bank, you know, it's a UK challenger bank, initially just B2C, but now very strongly also focus on B2B. So providing their challenger banking platform, you know, to other banks who want to create a digital bank. So that's, you know, interesting trends which we see. And it comes from the States, you know, when we think about Betterman, you know, the wealth tech companies in the United States, those companies were initially just focused on being a robo-advisor to the masses. And then they realized that's not easy to make money, because the average AUM size, you know, is so small. So again, the unit economics don't really work if the lifetime revenue of your client is less than the client acquisition costs, because it doesn't make sense. And so they all moved, yes, they moved into the B2B space, you know, they're advising now pension funds and moving into, you know, B2B wealth tech solution providers. So it is, and that's also, I think that's requires, you know, it's very flexible leaders and being able to creatively come up with strategic priorities, which might have in the past been not being seen as cohesive, you know, because you see B2B, B2C as two competitive business models. But in reality, you can drive both inside an organization successfully, you know, by having two different business teams, you know, doing that. So both is possible. So these are, I think, just the new strategic imperatives which we see emerging in front of our eyes.
That's very okay. That's interesting. And we do see and it does make sense in any market where the customer acquisition costs around of trust are really high. And I would argue if they're high in higher interest products like, you know, finance lending, banking lending, investment, mortgages, I'd argue mortgages actually maybe you don't do that often, but they're generally higher interest than insurance products. And so I think it's understanding the unit economics and also blending it, because it could very well be. I mean, we know we've done things. I remember we've done the first AI powered watch insurance in Europe. Guess what? Even in Switzerland, not that many people need an AI powered watch insurance. However, it was our flagship use case actually with the insurance to kind of say, listen, this is what we mean by a modern application. This is what this can do. And no, it doesn't have to cost $500,000 to build. And so I think it's having a B2C case, proving that the mechanics work. If that is a case that you want your partner to empower and bring truly verticalized solutions, right? Not just I don't think anyone is kind of going, hey, how about a cloud solution? I don't know anyone who's looking just for a cloud solution, right? So yes. I think that that makes a lot of sense. I guess as a wrap-up question, because you've mentioned, you know, we've mentioned fintech, regtech, proptech, insurtech, it's just, what do you think is the same? And what can, and maybe let's just focus on insurtech, because that's what a large part of our audience, what can insurtech take away from fintech? And what should it not take away because the analogy is too simplified?
Yes. I mean, I would say it starts out with the fact that most people, and I'm sorry when I say that now to an insurance audience, but most people don't like insurance. You know, most people feel it's unnecessary, you know, and that's wrong. You know, Nicolas, that's a wrong assessment. But I think lots of people feel insurance companies have not been fair to them in the past, have not paid out and that they were supposed to pay out. So there's often a lack of trust towards insurance companies. And I think the insure tech sector can completely change that, because the insure tech companies, I know, they are very much focused on gaining the trust of their clients, you know, being responsible, paying out what they promised. So I think that's a key thing, that the insure tech sector can be much more customer focused. And also speaking the language of the customer, you know, when you think about the insurance policies, you know, of the past, and even now, you know, when I look at large insurance policies, you know, we're dealing with as a company, they are so lengthy, you know, and so wordy, and you almost need to be a lawyer to understand them. But when you think about B2C insurance, you know, where the end customer has most likely not a law degree, but needs to understand what he gets insurance for, in simple words, I think there's so much improvement possible, you know, on a B2C insure tech side. And maybe insure tech has got the goal over time to bring the insurance sector closer to its customers. You know, maybe if only this goal is being fulfilled, it would make an enormous sense and would add so much value to both sides. But I think the key thing I would say about also insure tech and fintech have got in common is that entrepreneurs, you know, such as yourself, Nicolas, and such as Tom, that you are questioning the status quo, you know, that you are not happy with the status quo the way it is, that you find solutions for issues thousands of other people have seen as well, but didn't know what to do about. And you find there are ways to fix things, and you are brave enough, you know, to go after those issues and find solutions how to get a better, you know, a better solution, better products into the marketplace. And so I think that's the commonality between insurtech and fintech and regtech, that the entrepreneurs who are heading up these companies are visionaries. You know, they're brave visionaries who dedicate years of their lives to make our world a better place. And so I think that's super, of course, super exciting for me as investor, as an entrepreneur. You know, that's why I love this sector, because I think we're working in a sector which will make the world a better place. When I think about financial inclusion, you know, as another category of fintech, you know, 2 billion people with no bank accounts in the world, all of a sudden now with their mobile phones getting access to financial services, I mean, that's something, you know, that's huge. And so I think we all play a role to maybe post-corona to build up the world in a better way, you know, and I think that's a huge goal we have to fulfill. And I think we are just at the beginning of this journey.
I think that's a very good ending statement, I'd say. I don't know, Tom, anything to...
No, it's. I think the way you ended the podcast is nothing to add to it. And I think also our title, Reinventing Finance, shows a little bit in that direction. So nothing to add.
Yes. Perfect title. You chose it very well. Yes.
It was still free. So, Suzanne, thank you so much for your time. This was really interesting and I think really relevant for our listeners. And I just, for one, whilst I do enjoy not having to travel all that much, I am looking forward to what I am certain will be a buzzing fintech and insurtech conference scene once we're hopefully through and broken the third wave. And I'm sure that is exactly where we'll see each other again face to face. And in the meantime, best of luck. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It was a pleasure talking to you both.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.